All right, so we're talking about Jesus. And let me go ahead and try to spark your interest with this material. So people are very vocal nowadays about their belief in Jesus. I'll give you some examples of what people like to say, things that you may have heard on the street. And maybe as I give you some examples, you can think through some others that you have heard people say to you. People freely make random claims about Jesus, like, Jesus didn't exist. That is like believing in fairy tales. Grow up. Or you may have heard something like, Santa and leprechauns and unicorns and Jesus are my special helpers. They're all my good luck charms. You may have heard something like this. Jesus wasn't even convinced that he was the Son of God. That's why he called himself the Son of Man. Interesting. What about this? Jesus, like every other crazy who claims to be God, is delusional and needs psychiatric drugs. Pretty strong. What about Jesus never claimed to be the Son of God, but was mistakenly declared to be divine by his followers? Or, no one can be both God and man. It's logically impossible. Interesting. What about this? Jesus was a great teacher, maybe even a prophet, but definitely not God. Or what about, Jesus was just another one of God's sons? Or what about, Jesus was God like I am God and like you are God? What about, if Jesus was the prophesied Jewish Messiah, why don't the Jews believe? And how can all those Jews come and go and be wrong? What about, Jesus was a rebel, an anarchist, and one bad dude? Puff, puff. So what about you? You may have heard some things like this before. I'd love for you to share them. Do any come to mind in conversations you've had with people, or maybe you've had in the past yourself? Any other claims or against Jesus or doubts and skepticism concerning Jesus? Yes, Walter.
Atheists have said that the Bible is a group of stories for children that are afraid of the dark. And the response to that is that atheism is a group of stories for people that are afraid of the light.
Boom. In your face. They're pretty demeaning to us, but there's a good response. Other thoughts that you have? I'm just going to turn this up real quick.
Jesus is the greatest man ever lived.
Jesus is the greatest man that ever lived. Yeah. That says a lot. Maybe it doesn't say enough, according to Christians, right? Thanks, John. Chris, yeah. Yeah, that is a common one. Other thoughts? Yes,
well,
Jack.
Talking with Jehovah's Witnesses or Mormons, they don't believe in a deity, and it's always kind of interesting to really see where they believe he is or who he is.
Right. Yeah, they tend to really discount the divine statements that are there in the scripture. Yeah. Yeah, Caroline.
When Jesus was on earth with his disciples, even after his resurrection, when was it that he said in the latter part of the book of John, he alluded to the fact that he was coming back in their time period.
Mm-hmm.
But if he says no man knows the day nor the hour of the second coming, only God himself, is there a discrepancy there?
Yeah.
That's what I can't figure out.
Well, I think you're getting at something very interesting that people tend to point out is how can Jesus be God and be omniscient when there are times he says certain things like only the Father knows this? That is very interesting. Yes, absolutely. See, we're getting into some intriguing things already. We're not shying away from the hard stuff. Good stuff. Jonathan. Yeah, that's a good one. Yeah, Lisa. Right, Muslims say he's just a prophet. Yeah, that's all he is. Yes, Sarah, my wife. She's great, isn't she? She's really smart.
You took her to your class earlier.
Yeah, she already took the class. Yeah, this is all her stuff. I just she's the one that stays up late putting it all together.
You know, they say if God is your co-pilot, switch seats.
That's right. Good stuff. All right. Well, this is interesting. Yeah, let's get another. Who says that again?
The spiritists
say that he's a medium from the sixth sphere, right? Yeah. All right. So there you go. Now that is a good segue into what we're about to chat about. Skepticism in popular culture is also very much aided by the media. You may have seen a recent CNN documentary where Liam Neeson, our great actor now, our Taken world here, he narrates it. And he narrates this documentary, and he starts by saying, who was Jesus the man? Why is the greatest story ever told also the greatest mystery never solved? So this is quite the loaded question. The documentary features only liberal biblical scholars, such as Bart Ehrman, who guide the show along while advising on the very tough issues and questions that are brought up. And unfortunately, the program seems to provoke more skepticism than solutions. And so while surfacing engaging historical issues, in the end, the viewer is left with more skepticism than they came with. And this isn't just another example of why skepticism concerning Jesus is propagated and ongoing. So this is something we're faced with in the here and now. No matter what one believes about Jesus, no one can deny how important of a figure he is in the history of the world and the powerful influence he has, especially on Western cultures. Jesus has contributed more to the shaping of Western civilization than any other person. H.G. Wells said this, I am an historian. I am not a believer. But I must confess as a historian that this penniless preacher from Nazareth is irrevocably the very center of history. Jesus Christ is easily the most dominant figure in all of history. Another historian said this, as the centuries pass, the evidence is accumulating that, measured by his effect on history, Jesus is the most influential life ever to have lived on this planet. And so Jesus is important. I think probably 100% of scholars will agree with that. liberal or conservative. And even the person you meet on the street will agree that Jesus is important. Even the person that is an agnostic or an atheist. And Jesus can be used and has been used to bolster any strange idea, any religious idea, secular belief system, political idea, whatever injustice people have done in the past 2,000 years, such as the Spanish Inquisition, strange cults like the David Koresh cult in Waco, Texas, the Crusades, enslaving people, freeing slaves. Jews think he was a rabbi. Muslims think he was a prophet. Mormons think he was the Son of God, who didn't always exist. And recently, in an effort to incorporate Jesus, the Hindu religion, some Hindus, have taken on the idea that Jesus is one of their own in Hinduism. And revolutionaries want to make Jesus a revolutionary. Philosophers want to make him a philosopher. Jesus has been used and misused throughout the last 2,000 years, and everyone knows it. People usually adopt Jesus for their agenda, doctrines, and politics, no matter how moral or how hideous their agenda is. And it turns out that just as the people of his day tried to partisan him to understand him, we do the same thing today. We will define Jesus and redefine him until he comes back. And interestingly, although people bash God, people don't really bash Jesus. He's too compelling a figure. He's too powerful in word. He's too passionate in his deeds to bash. People will bash God, though. But Jesus is extremely respected by all who come across him. When Jesus' name is spoken in conversations with non-Christians, it automatically gets much, much more serious than if you just bring up God. People get very uncomfortable, especially in an office, workplace, kitchen setting. You may know what I'm talking about. If the name of Jesus is spoken there, things just get really weird really quick. Jesus' name is weighty. It's weighty. And even for secular philosophers, his teachings on morality, the human nature, and righteousness are unparalleled and regarded by most philosophers as some of the best philosophy that's ever been written. So Jesus is highly admired by our academic elites. And in a very existential sense, he is perhaps the most intriguing man to have ever lived. He is knowable, but he's mysterious. He's strong, but he's also sensitive. He's perfect, but he's so humble. And we all want to be, in this strange paradoxical way, face-to-face with Jesus, but not face-to-face with Jesus. Because we seem to have something to hide still. When we encounter him. And paradoxically, he is very overwhelming to anybody who come across him and encounter him. But somehow, he satisfies exactly as we hunger. He somehow fills us, but he somehow empties us, all at the same time. And strangely, regardless if we are Christian or not Christian, we all inexhaustibly need Jesus the same amount. We have this inexhaustible, insatiable need for Jesus. Whether you're the most holy monk to have ever walked this earth, or you're the worst of sinners, we all need Jesus the same amount. What one does with Jesus defines their lives and their afterlives. What we do with Jesus is the ultimate choice God will judge us on. So Jesus is absolutely incredible to encounter and to study. And that is where we're going here. We are hoping that as we study him, we will be able to encounter him in a different way than we ever have before. And hopefully, we will find just how amazing he is in the process. So Christianity, as a whole, rises and falls on the person of Jesus. How are Christians to respond to such allegations and statements that we hear about Jesus? What do Christians do? So we must ask, what do we really know about the historical Jesus? Is the historical Jesus the same Jesus as the Christ of faith? Liberal scholars nowadays like to differentiate these things. They say that the Christ of faith is very different than the historical Jesus. The Jesus of history, the guy that actually lived in first century Palestine and walked around preaching with disciples, is not the same person that Christians worship. So they differentiate between the two. They say, no, these are two different people. Not metaphysically speaking, but in their description. So upon historical reflection, what puzzle can we piece together about Jesus? And in this class, we'll attempt to answer the questions, did Jesus exist? Was Jesus really convinced that he was the Son of God? Was Jesus crazy, claiming to be the Son of God? Did Jesus really fulfill the attributes of God? Did Jesus and Jesus alone match the identity of the prophesied Messiah? And finally, of course, did Jesus really rise from the grave? So that's essentially the backdrop of this course and where we're going. And having said that, before we start the outline that you have, are there any questions on any of those things that we just talked about? Anything come to mind that stands out to you? Yes?
Are we going to talk about his pre-existence before coming to the death
of him? Right. Kind of. I'll just leave it at that. Yeah, because it gets very theologically heavy right before that. But when we do talk about Christology, we do bring that up, yeah. Yeah. Thoughts? Comments? Questions? Okay, well, let's go ahead and jump into the notes you have there, and we'll start talking about the first question having to do with Jesus' existence. Now, if you're a Christian in here, you may be shocked that you're at a class talking about whether or not Jesus exists. And you may be thinking, why am I here? I already am a Christian. I already know he exists, and he's the Messiah, and he's the Son of God, and so forth. Well, the whole point of apologetics, if you humor me for a moment, but in that binder, that spiral-bound book, I have a 40-page structured outline on why is apologetics necessary. And there's basically two reasons. One, it's for the Christian to have a more enhanced faith, and the other is to help the non-Christian understand how to arrange his doubts and think about them in light of certain evidences and reasons that are out there so that the doubts are diminished and he can eventually become face to face with Jesus. And so if you're a Christian and you don't know how to demonstrate that Jesus existed, then this class is for you. If you don't know how to show with evidence that Jesus rose from the grave, then this class is for you. Essentially, we're helping ourselves be better evangelists by understanding how to do pre-evangelism, which is necessary nowadays more than ever. So, in the outline you have there, we'll start with the top popular challenges to Jesus' existence. Well, I'm going to go ahead and go through my notes, and then when we come to fill in the blank, then you can just go for it there, or you can just use it to as a guide. You don't have to fill in any blanks. It's just for you to keep and have as essentially a guide. So things we just talked about, people say pretty wild things when it comes to Jesus and his existence. They say things also like this: Christians cannot be objective historians because they have a biased view and want Jesus to exist. So that's a pretty strong claim. And it relates to a lot of things that are based in philosophy, namely postmodernism, relativism, things like that. We'll talk about that in another class, but we'll address this hopefully tonight. Another thing people say is he didn't write anything down, so we don't know he existed because there's no evidence he left. You may have heard something like that. Or how about something like this, a little bit more challenging. The disciples of Jesus merely copied from the life of Apollonius of Tyana to create the story of Jesus. Interesting. How about the legend of Jesus is simply a retelling of similar stories from ancient mystery religions such as Mithraism? Yeah. You may never heard of Apollonius of Tyana or Mithraism, but this is something that is propagated all over the internet. And so we're going to hopefully get answers to these things and responses for them tonight. So popular skepticism and denial of Jesus' existence is all over the internet. Some popular online atheists and agnostics have strong views that Jesus did not exist. They passionately spread this view around online and in podcasts, and it picks up a lot of traffic because it is so enticing. And many of these agnostics and atheists laugh at Christians and blow them up on discussion forums because Christians typically don't defend the faith very well. And they say forcefully that Christians are irrational, holding to the view that Jesus existed. So it's not anymore that we have to defend God's existence. Now we have to defend Jesus' existence. And this rapid propagation of this view is just daunting. It's spreading like crazy. The Richard Dawkins Foundation, yes, he has one, could not resist stooping to a new low as they recently let a guy who just has a master's degree and wrote a self-published book on the belief that Jesus doesn't exist and attacking Christianity. They let him guest blog on their website. So this just goes to show you that any layperson who, you know, has a decent level of education could self-publish a book on, put it on Amazon, and start blogging all over the place. And the Richard Dawkins Foundation is so easygoing with this, with their quality control, if you will. They let him post on the website. So a big-time atheist thinker in our time, who's not a great atheist, actually, but, you know, this is helping propagate the view that Jesus does not exist. And it's from an untrained scholar. So now we're faced with the people that have a lot of traction, like Richard Dawkins, helping to put fuel on the fire here. It's interesting, though, that this same blogger guy with the self-published book, he says Christians are told to not get involved. He recommends that Christians not get involved because he already knows what they think. And it, actually, this turns out to be something that's more of a debate internally amongst atheists and agnostics. Many atheists believe and know that Jesus existed, but there's this new wave of atheism and agnosticism and this high level of skepticism coming through that are basically attacking the view that Jesus didn't exist, or that Jesus existed. This is a very recent phenomena. Up until our time, people in the West usually knew of the church's teachings. If you think of the medieval era, the Middle Ages, Enlightenment time, all of this in the Western world, people typically knew what the church is all about, knew some stuff about Jesus. They'd walk by the cathedral, see some statues. They'd get a sense for Jesus, disciples, do some good, go to heaven, you know. But in my reading, I've not come across anyone in the last 2,000 years, up until now, that thought that Jesus didn't exist. I'm talking about philosophers. I'm talking about historians. I'm talking about people writing plays, Dante, you know, people writing fiction books, things like that. No one said that I've come across that Jesus didn't exist up until now. The only thing that comes close is this school of thought out of Germany that started in 1880 and went on to about 1920. These are German theologians who were extremely liberal and kind of were a byproduct of Schleiermacher, who you don't need to know, but he did a lot of damage in terms of biblical scholarship. And this German group of scholars from over 100 years ago may be the academic source for the popular belief that we encounter today on the street. In other words, most of what we deal with comes from the college campuses, the university, the academic elites of a generation before. So I think what's happening here is that this history of religion school out of Germany that was very influential at the turn of the last century is something that has been dormant throughout the last 100 years and somehow has still been able to influence the masses. This group of scholars is called, I don't know if it's there on your notes, the weird German word. Religionsgeschichtliche. Did I get that right? It's basically the history of religion school. And they began to compare other ancient religions to Christianity to look for parallels and influences. So they kind of did this comparative religions thing. The Oxford reference says, at first they tried only to trace historical developments within Judaism and Christianity, but soon they came to search for parallels in Egyptian, Babylonian, and Hellenistic religious systems. So they started to look for parallels with all these other religions around the time of Jesus. They started to try to find out, is there anything that is from this religion that looks similar to this religion over here? Is there something that we could say may have influenced this religion from that religion? But this group of liberal theologians and Bible scholars were more interested in comparative religions and showing the influences of neighboring religions than in showing that Jesus didn't exist. One of their more prominent scholars wrote to a group of American theologians in a scholarly journal, one of the most well-respected and esteemed academic scholarly journals. And this guy in Germany, this theologian, from that school of thought, from that camp, said, moreover, the same may be said concerning the exceedingly difficult task of explaining the origin of Christianity, which already in the preaching of Jesus presupposes the peculiarity, I think I wrote that wrong, peculiarity of complicated religious history of late Judaism. So he was basically saying that what we're trying to do is do something that's very difficult, understand how to explain the origin of Christianity in light of the preaching of Jesus. So he's already affirming and admitting the preaching of Jesus there. He's just trying to understand, did legendary development creep in over time as the disciples wrote down the things that Jesus said and did? So their work doesn't really have anything to do with whether Jesus existed, but this whole idea of finding influences and comparing these other nearby religions may be what's fueling this fire that we have today. People who are saying things like the disciples borrowed from these ancient mystery religions of, say, Mithraism, or they compared Jesus to this Apollonius of Tyana who did these miracles in the area. And so the legendary developments crept in. Well, it turns out that this group of scholars had their work refuted a long time ago. And according to a scholar now, he says that it's now regarded as out of date, and they are known for a good century later to have been mistaken. So this school of thought basically is left in history, and now we are dealing with the aftermath. So it's clear that this small blip in the history of scholarship has been dormant until our time. And so now we are faced with, well, how do we show that Jesus did exist? We have to consider these questions. What evidence is available? How do we make sense of the evidence? Can we show Jesus existed without the Bible? So we're trying to now dive in at this point and consider certain pieces of evidence that would help us justify the claim that we are making as Christians that Jesus existed. We are making that claim, so we bear the burden of proof. So right after the break, we're going to look into some pieces of evidences, and we're going to build our case. Yes, Jonathan. That's a good question. I think the new atheists, namely, yeah, there's four guys that are kind of the main dudes for the new atheists: Daniel Dennett, Richard Dawkins, Christopher Hitchens, who just passed away, and Sam Harris. And these new atheists, as they've been labeled, are militant atheists in that they're very forceful, adamant, and extremely attacking in nature. Rather than having more of a calm, friendly kind of dialogue. It's not that they're yelling, but it's just that their words are so much more aggressive than we're used to. And so the new atheists, though, I don't think hold that Jesus existed. Although on a radio show I recently listened to with Dawkins, he came on and started to question and kind of give rise to the idea that maybe he thinks that Jesus didn't exist, but I don't think Dawkins holds that view. It's more of an online sort of thing amongst lay atheists and agnostic rather than the professional or scholarly atheist. I don't know if that helps.
So these atheists, are they really anti-Christians? Are they anti-Islam or Hindus?
The new atheists tend to be anti-religion in general. They kind of want to get rid of religion and altogether. They want to rid the world of religion. But they really don't like Christianity because they're in the West and Christianity is very dominant compared to, say, Hinduism or something. So they tend to try to point to the weaknesses and failures of Christianity and such. So, yeah. Other questions, thoughts? Chris, yeah.
Yeah, to the subject that you were talking about, and how people don't believe in Jesus, there was a movie that was produced actually in regards to a German school that actually got shut down just over time, but it was called Zeitgeist, and it got brought back into life in, I think, early 2000s or late 2000s. So a lot of atheists hit this because it hit YouTube, and so that's why
That's great. Mark Forman, check him out on YouTube, breaks the view of Zeitgeist down. Thanks, Chris. That's great. Okay, let's go ahead and take a 5-minute break here. There are some few snacks in the back, and then feel free to connect with each other, get to know somebody, introduce yourself. People tend to be real shy, so be friendly. All right, we'll be back in 5 minutes. Okay, now we're at point 5 there in your handout, the existence evidence on the page 2. And you should have page 2 if you got the handout that he passed around the second time, because the first handout did not have page 2. It didn't have page 4 or 6 either, because it went through the copy machine and didn't do the double-sided thing. So if your page 2 is not there, go to the other handout that may be in front of you. Okay, so we're at the existence evidence. So we're going to start there. Interestingly, there is more credible evidence for Jesus' existence than most other famous persons in history. So for historians, it's not an issue or a question of whether or not Jesus existed. Historians don't send each other essays or write back and forth to each other on this matter. They take it as fact that Jesus existed. 99.9999% of historical scholars confirm the existence of Jesus, or do not deny it. Let's put it that way. So 0.1%, if you will. Actually, it's probably even less than that, but 0.1% of scholars who are skeptical may deny his existence. Now, where did I get that from? I'll tell you how I got that 0.1% in a little bit. There's much more evidence that Jesus existed 2,000 years ago than there will be for your existence 2,000 years from now. So 2,000 years from now, if Jesus doesn't return, I guarantee you no one will know you existed unless you are the president or some influential senator or philosopher or thinker of some sort. Maybe movie star, maybe not. Unless maybe you're like a playwright or, I don't know, something like that. It would be very hard to determine that you existed 2,000 years from now. However, who?
Google,
yeah. Maybe no one will be able to know that Google existed 2,000 years from now. Do you remember when everything was on paper, you know, there weren't any computers? You know, we have these drawings. I work in structural engineering. And for buildings, sometimes they retrofit the building and a structural engineer gets involved and things like that. And we try to go find the drawings from like a building that was built in 1950. And sometimes we have to go to the city and we have to go look through their microfilms, whatever it's called, and dig up stuff like that because they don't have a physical copy of the blueprints, the plans. And they just don't exist. And sometimes that's the case for buildings built in like 1990 and later. So it just goes to show you that once you start looking for things from the past, you start realizing a lot gets thrown away. And this happens all the time. So it's quite fascinating that we have records from 2,000 years ago concerning certain people. The basic outline of the facts about Jesus' life are extremely hard to reject. He's from Nazareth, he lived in Galilee, he died in Jerusalem. These things are extremely hard to deny. Because the evidence pointing toward the existence of Jesus of Nazareth is internal to the Bible, but is also external. So externally, we have several Roman historians, a Jewish historian, some other Jewish documents, and a Greek writer that have all discussed Jesus in one way or another. Now, I haven't given you the quotes there, but let's start with Josephus. Josephus was a first century Jewish historian. I believe he was employed by Rome, and he wrote many, many books. And it turns out that he actually saw, I believe, the destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70, and even one of the last battles of the holdout of the Jewish zealots against the Romans, who were coming to then conquer, basically, and spread out all the Jews. He saw that at Masada. If you've ever been to Israel, you know Masada, where I'm talking about, in the middle of the Dead Sea area. It's this huge cliff way above the Dead Sea, overlooks that whole region. And there is a fortress there with Herod the Great having basically a hideout in case he needed to go hide out from the Romans and defend himself. The problem is, this fortress was built so remotely, it was hard to have anything sustainable taking place there. No ability really to get crops or anything up there. The Romans eventually built up a ramp and invaded and somehow conquered it. And Josephus saw this all go down. Anyway, Josephus was very, very detailed in his history. He watched his people crumble, and he wrote in detail the history of the Jews, I believe, for the Roman emperors to have in the history books. And Josephus is one of the most reliable historians of the era. He wrote this concerning Jesus. Quote, "And brought before them the brother of Jesus, who was called Christ, whose name was James, and some others. And when he had formed an accusation against them as breakers of the law, he delivered them to be stoned." So the context there is a little vague. I'm not going to give you the whole context, but the point is, he's writing about Jesus right there. Another quote from Josephus. "At this time, there was a wise man who was called Jesus, and his conduct was good, and he was known to be virtuous. And many people from among the Jews and other nations became his disciples. Pilate condemned him to be crucified, and those who had become his disciples did not abandon his discipleship. They reported that he had appeared to them 3 days after his crucifixion, and that he was alive." End quote. This is all from a Jewish historian, Josephus. Now, keep in mind that the Jews were not particularly friendly to Christianity at the time. They thought of it as a cult. They were against it. They wanted to bash it in many ways. So some critics take that quote and say that the Christians later wrote in exactly what I just read, and Josephus never said it. So that is controversial, and I'm telling you that now so you know that this is subjected to criticism. But other scholars will acknowledge adamantly that this is Josephus's own words. So, be that as it may, we'll keep going here. Jewish Talmud is another document that goes from a 2nd century to the 4th or 5th century. The Talmud consists of the Mishnah and the Gemara. And this is basically a commentary, if you will, on Jewish practices, Jewish history, that was written by a bunch of rabbis, and it had additional rabbinic teaching in it. And there are some quotes there that are also controversial, but this is what it says. "Jesus the Nazarene practiced magic and deceived and led Israel astray." Again, written by the Jews who were trying to be counterproductive to the Christian cause. So they're slandering Jesus essentially here. It goes on to say that Jesus the Nazarene was hanged, and a herald went forth before him 40 days heralding, "Jesus the Nazarene is going to be stoned because he practiced sorcery and instigated and seduced Israel to idolatry. Whoever knows anything in defense may come and state it." And then it says, "But since they did not find anything in his defense, they hanged him on the eve of Passover," which is when we know Jesus died. So here we have Jewish bashing of Jesus here. Jewish people trying to discredit Jesus to the readers. They are trying to cut off the movement, the way, as it was called. And so,
whenever Jesus did miracles, some of the Jews believed in him and some of them did not, so they think those are the people who became this category and they call them magic.
Yeah, I think that's what's going on, yeah. That they're calling Jesus a magician, a sorcerer, things like this, because they're trying to discredit him. They're trying to say that Jesus led people astray. Now, what you don't find here in the Josephus quotes or in this quote from the Talmud is that Jesus didn't exist. You didn't see there somebody saying, don't listen to the disciples, don't listen to his followers. Jesus never lived. What they're trying to do is discredit the man who actually lived. So keep that in mind. Now, the Roman historian Cornelius Tacitus, he's very well known and wrote some great history of the Roman Empire. He brings up Christus, the name Christus. He doesn't call him Christ, because I think that's more the Latin word for Christ. He says there's a class hated for their abominations called Christians by the populace. Christus, from whose name had its origin, suffered the extreme penalty during the reign of Tiberius at the hands of one of our procurators, Pontius Pilate. And a most mischievous superstition, checked for the moment, again broke out, not only in Judea, the source of all evil, but even in Rome, and goes on. So here you have attestation by a Roman historian that Jesus existed. There's this group of Christians that are following him. He died at the hands of Pontius Pilate during the reign of Tiberius, and this movement was checked for a moment, but again it broke out and spread from Judea. Also, Roman historian Gaius Suetonius, in his book, The Lives of the 12 Caesars, said this, quote, "He expelled from Rome the Jews, constantly making disturbances at the instigation of Crestus." So he's talking about how, I think it was Nero expelled from Rome the Jews who kept talking about Jesus or the Christ. A Roman Syrian historian, Mara Bar Serapion, if I'm saying that right, not sure, he said, "What advantage did the Athenians gain from murdering Socrates? Famine and plague came upon them as punishment for their crime. What advantage did the men of Samos gain from burning Pythagoras? In a moment their land was covered with sand. What advantage did the Jews gain from executing their wise king? It was just after that their kingdom was abolished," referring to the Roman invasion of AD 70. "God justly avenged these three wise men." Da-da-da, he talks about the other two guys. And then he says that the wise king is because of the new law he laid down. So he continues to live. He says Socrates is not dead, Pythagoras continues to live, and the wise king essentially continues to live. So this was the Roman Syrian historian. Okay, so he's comparing Jesus in that quote to these other wise men who lived, and he's saying, see, when these wise men were persecuted and tortured by their own people, bad things happened, but the wise men continued on after the persecution and the torture, essentially. The Roman governor of Bithynia, Pontus, which is Turkey, Pliny the Younger, he wrote to the emperor about what to do with the Christians. He wasn't sure. They weren't worshiping the Roman gods, and they seemed to be living a countercultural life. He says, "They affirmed, however, that the whole of their guilt or their error was that they were in the habit of meeting on a certain fixed day," talking about Sunday, "before it was light, early in the morning, when they sang in alternate verse a hymn to Christ as to God, as to a God, and bound themselves in a solemn oath not to any wicked deeds, but never to commit any fraud, theft, adultery, never to falsify their word, not to deny a trust when they should be called upon to deliver it up." So he's talking about how Christians met early in the morning on the first day of the week. They sang hymns to Christ as to God. They took oaths together, and they decided to live good lives and not go back on their claims, not go back on their commitment. So obviously he's talking about the Christian church and saying it was to this person, Christ, who they worshipped as God. Another Roman historian, Lucian of Samosata, wrote in one of his plays, actually. He was a great historian, but he developed a play to essentially criticize Christianity. "The Christians," he says, "you know, worship a man to this day, the man who was crucified in Palestine because he introduced this new world to a cult. You see, these misguided creatures start with the general conviction that they are immortal for all time, which explains the contempt of death and voluntary self-devotion, which are so common among them. And then it was impressed on them by their original lawgiver that they are all brothers from the moment that they are converted and deny the gods of Greece and worship the crucified sage." and live after his laws. So anyway, he goes on to talk more about Christians, but again, pointing to the existence of Jesus right here in his writing. Now, there are a couple more, and I won't bother reading them. The Phlegon of Tralles and the Roman author Celsus. What I'm trying to do by reading you a few of these quotes is get you to see that there is significant data available for everyone to review that concerns the existence of Jesus explicitly. And there are others that I don't have there where the existence of Jesus is implied by the writing. Now, this is also only extra-biblical, non-Christian sources. Celsus, in fact, was an extreme critic of Christianity. He's kind of more like one of the new atheists, if you will, of that era. He's very aggressive in his attacks against Christianity. And so Celsus was responded to by different Christian apologists of the time. And so there's some dialogue there that we can uncover. So the critics of Christianity are confirming the existence of Jesus at the time. No one is saying, why are Christians believing in this mythical person, Jesus? No one is saying that because they all know he was there. Interestingly, 2nd century Christian apologists Justin Martyr and Tertullian refer others to the Roman archives of the region for the registration of Joseph and Mary during the census when Jesus was born during the reign of Caesar Augustus. So Justin Martyr and Tertullian know that in that region, in the Bethlehem area, there would have been a census taken, there would have been data collected on certain people who lived in the region. And they wanted people to know that the story can be validated and verified. They were convinced that such a record was available, and Justin Martyr says this, there is a village in Judea, 35 stadia from Jerusalem, where Jesus Christ was born, as you can see from the tax registers under Cyrenius, your first procreator in Judea. So it's like us referring to going to the Orange County Hall of Records in Santa Ana and looking up something. And then many other Christian bishops and theologians write concerning the historical Jesus within 150 years after his life. Ignatius, Polycarp, Justin Martyr, Tertullian, Irenaeus, the Epistle of Barnabas has something on it, the Didache, Clement, Bishop of Rome, Quadratus, Bishop of Athens. And again, some of these Christians that later became pastors and bishops, they were hostile to Christianity at first, and they write about it in their writings. Again, this is within 100 years of Jesus' life. Quadratus says, "The deeds of our Savior were always before you, for they were true miracles. Those that were healed, those that were raised from the dead, who were seen not only when healed and when raised, but were always present. They remained living a long time, not only while our Lord was on the earth, but likewise when he had left the earth, so that some of them have also lived to our times." He's talking about the disciples and followers of Jesus who are around, who experience Jesus face to face. The Gospel of Thomas is another early gospel. The Gnostic Gospels are also available. They're a little later, though. But the Gospel of Thomas is quite early, according to some scholars. And the earlier, the better, in terms of getting a higher quality piece of evidence concerning the life of Jesus. So overall, several biblical, extra-biblical writings record details concerning the life, teaching, death, and resurrection of Jesus and the early church all within 150 years of Jesus' death. So we have a tremendous amount of evidence. We have a tremendous amount of data giving us details about the life of Jesus outside of the Bible. Now, within the Bible, we have obviously an incredible rich document full of evidence on Jesus' actual life and actual existence. last class, we talked about whether or not those documents are reliable. Now, many non-Christians, skeptics, will easily dismiss the Bible as something that can be used as evidence. They just think it's something like a Joseph Smith's Book of Mormon or Muhammad's Quran, where in reality, that is just a false assumption altogether. We have documents that were written between AD 40 and AD 90, over 50 years, by several different types of people, different personalities, different places around the Mediterranean. And each document is grouped together to form the, what we have as the New Testament. And we talked about the canon formation last class. I want to express that if you are in a conversation with someone who dismisses the Bible as available evidence because it's biased or because it's the source of Christianity, I'd like you to consider revisiting that with them, or not going down the rabbit trail of just going to the extra-biblical evidence first. Because the Bible has these embarrassing features to it, and this information that is kind of inconsequential and insignificant, these reports and these little details that are just like, who cares? Why bother saying this or that? And these other embarrassing features lend it the idea that, or give the view that the Bible is reporting accurately as possible. We have genuine marks of historicity right there in the text. If there weren't any embarrassing accounts, then we could be suspect of it. But the disciples put themselves in embarrassing light all the time. Jesus is doing very confusing things all over the place, and there's a lot of confusion and almost disagreement when you read Paul's epistles and James and some other accounts in the scriptures, if you read it real quickly and don't dive in. So let's consider Paul real quick. His early letters reflect a commonly held belief in the earliest earliest Christians about the historical person of Jesus. Galatians, for example, was the first writing in the New Testament. It was written only 15 years after the death of Jesus. Paul met James, the half-brother of Jesus, who would have told Paul that he had no such half-brother. So can you imagine when Paul goes and he has this Damascus Road vision, and later on he goes over to Jerusalem and he meets Peter, James, and John there. Can you imagine if they said, dude, that dude wasn't really here. That was a vision. We saw that vision too. Trippy, huh? No, they didn't do that. They said, yeah, this is what it was like. And they started filling him in on the details of what it was like to live with Jesus, not to live with the ghost. So Paul met all the disciples and spent 3 years with them before he started on his missionary journeys. So Paul knew that Jesus ate, slept, was born, and died. Paul did not think of him as a ghost. And all of this is independent data prior to the Gospels being penned. Paul wrote Corinthians, Galatians, and a couple other books, I believe, prior to Mark even being written. So when you want to start talking about early evidence, you start with Paul, because he provides the earliest evidence. Now, if Paul heard that Jesus wasn't real, then he would have said so. He wouldn't have talked about the body of Christ and different things like this that are littered throughout Paul's writings. So we have a real, true Jesus explicitly stated throughout Paul, and it's implied as well in different texts. The book of Acts also is the most raw account of the apostles' behavior right after his death, resurrection, and ascension. All within 50 days of Jesus' resurrection and ascension, we have this vivid story of Peter coming out on the day of Pentecost and preaching this incredible message so raw and so authentically. It has the marks of of historicity right there. You can tell that it's genuinely Peter coming out. The gospel accounts right there are very reliable and written from an eyewitness perspective. The gospels detail basic and even some mundane facts about Jesus as a historical person. When it says that Jesus resurrected and he had breakfast with John on that beach, he was eating the fish, right? Where is the fish going if he's a ghost? Okay? He's not able to actually pick it up, really, to eat it if he's a ghost, right? So you think of these things. So much of what was written about Jesus was embarrassing and awkward. His favor to the women and his willingness to bend and break the rules. I mean, we have it all over the place in the Gospels. This is the sort of thing that as a Jew, as a Jewish disciple of Jesus, you know that you don't want to tell people about because you're going to get in trouble. You wouldn't make up these weird things that happen, these weird sayings of Jesus, because you know you're just going to get punished by the Jewish authorities. It is absolutely absurd to think that the disciples made up all of these things, all these inconsequential details, and all of these bad things that Jesus was doing, essentially, at the time, according to the religious authorities, as a lie. They went on and died for it, too. So it's hard to imagine, it's impossible to imagine, that someone would make all this stuff up and then die for it. Consider the Sabbath activity, Jesus breaking the rules on the Sabbath, feet washing with your subordinates, washing the feet of people that are looking up to you. These are things that religious rabbis don't do. He says, woes to you, teachers of the law and Pharisees, you hypocrites, you shut the kingdom of heaven in men's faces. Do you think the disciples would make that up and then spread that idea amongst the religious elite of the time and say, no, this guy didn't exist, but they made up this statement, woe to you, teachers of the law and Pharisees, you hypocrites, you shut the kingdom of heaven in men's faces. No, the disciples did not make up that sentence. That was said by someone who had no shame at all, who had incredible confidence. Jesus died of a shameful execution. Why would the disciples write about this? Their leader has fallen. Everything is lost. Why would they write about their leader dying in such a way? This is like writing about say you're in a cult and your leader gets put to death by the electric chair or chemicals nowadays. Would you go on and write about it to spread the cult further after that? No. You're talking about the difference between the Greek and Hebrew culture when the leader dies. Yeah. It's interesting because we know the Hebrew culture very well in the first century. We have the Apocrypha leading up to the first century, and we have the Talmud, and we have Josephus. We have all these sources. So we know exactly what sorts of things would be shameful and honorable at the time. Scholars like to point out the shame honor culture of the first century. And that's really a good way to understand the ancient Near East, and especially in Palestine. The honor-shame dynamic is something that we Westerners really don't have a good grasp on. And many preachers, you know, of our era and our geography do not talk about the honor-shame culture of Judaism in the first century. And this is something that is very tangible to the disciples. They are living in this honor-shame culture. Everything they do and think is about honor and shame. Being around the women, letting the women speak up, letting the women's testimony drive the events of the day, and all of these other things that were happening that were completely opposite of how things went down typically. That's why the story of Jesus is so fascinating, because you see the world being turned upside down in the Gospels when you understand the context, when you understand the background, of course. So why would they make it all up if it wasn't real? Why would they turn the world upside down and helping people understand that this new religion, this new way to connect with God, is all just for their own benefit when they later on and go and die for it? So internally and externally, we have multiple lines of evidence that point to the existence of a historical figure. So this is the fun part now. What do other scholars like to say? Well, what about people like Bart Ehrman? People like Bart Ehrman. Bart Ehrman, if you don't know, is an extremely liberal Bible scholar who likes to criticize Christianity and popularize his ideas to the masses. So what about hyper-skeptical scholars like Bart Ehrman? E-H-R-M-A-N. Bart, like in Bart Simpson. Okay, so you can get the spelling there. Bart Ehrman is just one of the many famous agnostics or atheists historians that affirm Jesus' existence. Now, again, Bart Ehrman is someone who Christians squirm when they hear his name because he is such a influential person in the pop culture we have today. His books are all over Barnes & Noble, and he's all over these CNN documentaries, and he goes around debating Christian philosophers and apologists and Bible scholars. So he was a guest one time on this this radio show or podcast called The Infidel Guy. Okay, so think infidels, and then his name's Infidel Guy. Okay, so The Infidel Guy actually brought Ehrman on, thinking that Ehrman would go along with the view that Jesus didn't exist. So Ehrman wound up lighting him up on his own show, making him look foolish on his own show. He said this on his show: "I unfortunately get quoted as someone who thinks that Jesus didn't exist. I have written an entire book on what Jesus said and did. And for him to say anything, he had to exist." So obviously, I think he exists. So this guy, though, kind of kept pushing him, like, well, I don't know, shouldn't we be skeptical, though, that Jesus existed? And Ehrman's like, no, what are you talking about? He says, we have more evidence for Jesus than we do of anybody from his time period. You have to look at the evidence. There is hard evidence. Why would he lie about it? They have the off-the-cuff, disinterested comments from someone that actually knew him. I am a historian, and I'm telling you, end quote. That is Ehrman telling the host of the show this. I am a historian, and I'm telling you, there's off-the-cuff, disinterested comments from people that actually knew him. You have to look at the evidence. There's hard evidence. Ehrman's own words, okay? Needless to say, the infidel guy was caught off guard, and he was his skepticism was refuted by someone that is wild and crazy like Bart Ehrman in terms of his extreme liberal ideology. Now, this goes on after a few years on the internet. Continued rumors that Ehrman thinks that Jesus didn't exist are propagated all over the web. So Ehrman was tired and fed up with it. He said, I'm going to write a book. So he wrote a book called Did Jesus Exist? The Historical Argument for Jesus of Nazareth. That's the title of the book. The Historical Argument for Jesus of Nazareth. So Ehrman's book is in Barnes & Noble now. It was published in 2012. And you can go pick it up. Again, Ehrman is one of the sharpest and extreme critics of Christianity today, and he is trying to refute himself. He's turning and looking at all the atheists that are rallying behind him and saying, guys, what are you talking about? You're crazy. Stop being foolish. Jesus existed. This is what's written on the back of the book. The Jesus you discover here may not be the Jesus you hope to meet, but he did exist, whether we like it or not. So, obviously, Ehrman is coming out full frontal attack on his own followers. Now, I only know of three scholars who think that Jesus did not exist. And when I say scholar, I mean an authoritative, experienced, knowledgeable historian, not a philosopher or scientist, a historian with a professorship somewhere, credible. When I say scholar, I'm not talking about someone that writes blogs. I'm not talking about the guys on the Facebook groups. Okay? Now, there are three, maybe four, but let's say three. And the three that I'm talking about are also talked about by folks like Ehrman and others who are trying to refute these atheists. So it's not just the three that I know of. It's really these are the only three that anybody knows of who are willing to be that wild and crazy and say that Jesus didn't exist. Robert Price, Earl Doherty, and Richard Carrier. Now, those three names are tossed around by every person online trying to propagate the idea that Jesus didn't exist. They refer to Robert Price because he's the bigger one. Richard Carrier now has probably emerged as one of the bigger fringe scholars on the topic. And so anybody you see or anybody talking online is going to refer to these guys. Again, these three are very much on the fringe. So you have a liberal group of theologians. They meet and talk about their liberal theology and scholarship. And then there's guys that are beyond them, and they're more fringe. And I'm saying these are the three fringe guys that are out there. Come to find out that these are the guys that this guy, Maurice Casey, he just passed away. He's another New Testament scholar in the UK. And he's written tons and tons of books. He's like as big as F.F. Bruce and Bruce Metzger and all these other big New Testament scholars in the last century. And he argues that these scholars, these three guys, have a reliance on work that which is out of date, most of which was questionable quality when it was written, mostly in the 19th and early 20th centuries. That's that German group I told you about that these three tend to derive some of their insights from. And he says this level of incompetence is rare in conventional scholarship. So that's a huge blast. When you're talking about academics, when they write back and forth to each other, they typically don't say things that powerful. He says this level of incompetence is rare in conventional scholarship when he's talking about the three guys that deny Jesus' existence. Another extreme liberal scholar, but not as fringe as the other guys, John Dominic Crossan, he even says of those three guys that they are, quote, an academic embarrassment. An academic embarrassment. I mean, you cannot get more hostile in your words as an academic scholar than that. That is extreme for academia. Now, we only have about 10 more minutes, so we'll look at quickly the responses to the challenges, and then we'll close up, okay? Any questions so far on some of the scholars talk that we just went through? Yeah, Wilton.
As far as I know, there are no writings, Jewish or otherwise, that deny the miracles.
Yeah.
If someone wrote that these miracles occurred, you would think that some Jewish scholar would say, hey, they didn't exist.
Yeah. Yeah, there's no one refuting the miracle reports. Yeah, that's a very good point. Well, the Jews started calling them magic, yeah.
But they didn't say that
they didn't happen.
Lazarus didn't come back to life, or the blind did not see.
Right.
The lame did not walk.
What are they pointing to when they say it's magic? What is that referring to? It's referring to some activity that people are reporting as miracles. Yeah, the source of the power, even. Yeah. Other comments, thoughts? Yes, Carolyn.
All throughout Jewish history, nobody, even the greatest of teachers and sages, no one had ever healed a blind man from birth. But Jesus did that. Okay. And this is what, because even in their writings, expected their Messiah to be able to do this kind of thing. And then when Jesus was proclaiming to be this Messiah and doing this, but they didn't validate so many other things about him, they took a long and extensive investigation. It wasn't just overnight they decided Jesus wasn't valid. They really investigated him. And they sent secret agents out to see what he was doing and appear among the crowds and all kinds of stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, there was a bit of an investigation on the part of the Jewish rabbis at the time, the Pharisees, Sadducees, they really did question him quite a lot. They did really look into, what is this guy all about? Yeah, so you get that reported in the Gospels as well. Yeah, Chris.
Just a quick question. I'm going back to the historian Flavius Josephus. He said something that some people, skeptics or critics, said that he didn't say this. Say something in there. They said that he didn't really mean that or say that.
Yeah. Yeah, I haven't studied it very thoroughly, but from what I know is that it's charged that he probably didn't say this, and this is something that the Christian scribes wrote in centuries later to make the apologetic argument more substantial. Again, that's an accusation made by whoever to try to discredit that passage in Josephus. Is the accusation founded on anything? I haven't looked into it much. But everything I brought up, every Roman historian here, is considered to be writing incredible history of the Roman Empire at the time. And as they write the history, they're inserting comments about Jesus. So you have some substantial sources right there. There's no doubt in my mind that Josephus didn't write that. So I really think he wrote it. I mean, it's pretty clear. You can look at the other thing is look at the manuscripts way back then. And then you have to kind of be a manuscript expert, or you could talk to some. Like, there's a guy that was at the Calvary Chapel conference last apologetics conference, the Veritas conference, that, you know, brought out all of his scrolls and everything. So, I mean, a guy like that would definitely be able to tell you. But, yeah, it's a good question. Julie. Yeah, that's
it's
true.
Only the description that they say the Christians added later to make it sound better.
Yeah, now that you mentioned that, that rings a bell. Thanks. Yeah, that helps. It's just a part of it. I'm not sure which part.
Well, they don't deny the second part that James, the brother of Jesus, called the Christ.
Yeah.
Nobody denies that.
Right.
They don't even want to talk about it.
Right. Yeah, it's pretty daunting. I mean, this case that we've made so far is just, I mean, you're a lawyer, you know, is this a good case or not? It's pretty irrefutable.
I'm here.
You have like I said, I think this is, if you're going to make a case for anything in apologetics, this is watertight. I mean, it's just irrefutable case that Jesus existed. Like I said, if you have three scholars in the world who deny or at least say they're skeptical about it, then you know that the evidence is just overwhelming. So anyway, we could talk more about that. Now, the challenges. How do we respond to the challenges? Well, there's a lot we could say here. Christians can't be objective historians because they have a biased view of Jesus. Well, this is just a genetic fallacy, meaning that when someone charges that you cannot hold that view, or that view is unreliable because you got that view this certain way in the past. For instance, you learned that 2 + 2 = 4 by your mom, who was a crack addict. So you can't trust the statement 2 + 2 = 4. You can't know that to be true because of the source. So what it does, it tears apart the truth of this proposition itself with how you got the proposition. So that's a genetic fallacy, the genes, the genetics of how it came to be. So we want to say in response, okay, first of all, it doesn't matter how I got this view that I hold. My view says this, and the truth of my view is established by independent evidence. And that evidence has to be dealt with in its own right. You have to attack that evidence I'm bringing up, not how my view was generated or created. So we need to be mindful and watch out for the genetic fallacy. Christians can be objective historians, and many Christians are top-notch historians and regularly attend all the same scholarly academic conferences all around the globe, just like all the non-Christian historians and other scholars. So we go to the same conferences, write in the same journals, and do the same type of great academic work. Of course, Christians can be objective historians. Also, this charge is essentially claiming that objective history can't be known because of one's religious cultural predisposition, and one can only see events from their skewed perspective. So when someone says that you can't be a good historian because of where you come from and what you're all about, we have to reject that, because many historians are writing on the history of their own nation. How many American historians do we have writing on the Civil War? There's umpteen billion documents and historical writings on the Civil War, all written by American scholars. Can they not write that history because they're from America? No. All right, so let's keep moving. Clearly, historians can be objective when writing on the history of their own religions and cultures. In fact, if you want to talk about that more, you could say that the disciples were Jewish. They weren't Christian. When they wrote down their stuff, they didn't say, okay, now I'm a Christian and I'm not a Jew anymore. No, Judaism lived on within Christianity for a long time. That's why Paul tried to differentiate everything in his letters. So Christians were Jews first, and they wrote about a Jewish Messiah. What's that?
Messianic Jews.
Yeah, now they're Messianic Jews. So Christianity is what resulted. It came out of Judaism. It came because the Jews were writing about the Messiah. So you have Christianity emerging from Judaism by Jews. Secular historians also agree that Jesus existed. So someone who charges you can't be an objective historian and hold that view because you're a Christian, well, secular historians agree with the same thing I'm saying. So, of course, my view is backed up. Now, that's why I was saying that 99% of legit historians acknowledge Jesus' existence. All right. Now, let's go ahead and move on. He did not write anything down or leave any evidence. There is no way to know he existed. So when people say he didn't write anything down or leave anything any evidence, this is just plainly absurd. One doesn't have to write anything down to actually exist. Socrates never wrote anything down. Plato wrote all of his stuff for him. But no philosopher thinks that Socrates didn't exist. No philosopher thinks that Plato just made up Socrates as teacher. They may question, well, who wrote more? Who wrote what? Did Plato really write that, or is he just misinterpreting Socrates, or what? They debate on that, but no philosopher thinks that Socrates didn't exist. And finally, Jesus didn't exist. No more believing in fairy tales. You may hear people say that. Well, one, those who claim Jesus existed bear the burden of proof. We claim it, we bear the burden, we've successfully carried the burden. So we have outstanding positive evidence for Jesus' existence that is practically irrefutable. We have external evidence and internal evidence to back up our claim that he existed. And this is from all different types of people and places like we saw. Also, 99% of historical scholars confirm the existence of Jesus. So again, 99% of historical scholars confirm the existence of Jesus. Appealing to knowledgeable people, by the way, is not a fallacy. Appealing to the masses is a fallacy. So if you're using your argumentation, do not appeal to the masses. Appeal to the people who are knowledgeable and relevant to that topic. All right, so with the 1 minute I have left, in order for skepticism in the belief in Jesus to be justified, the skeptical person would either need to, one, discredit our positive evidence that we have already shown. That evidence would need to be discredited. Or two, present positive evidence of refutations made by the apostles and their contemporaries. So again, in order for skepticism to be justified, that's the blank, The skeptical person would need to discredit the evidence we've shown or present positive evidence that shows that the claims the disciples and apostles were making were lies, essentially. So it's very difficult to refute the positive evidence we provided. So that's practically impossible because we have so much of it. And two, to present positive evidence of the refutations made by first century citizens and contemporaries is very hard to do. In fact, we don't have any positive evidence of refutations that Jesus existed. We don't have any documents of any Roman historian saying, no, these Christians are making stuff up, Jesus never existed. We don't have any of that. They would need to produce one or the other. They can't do both. So therefore, our argument is solid. The thought experiment I won't do right now, but essentially we need to ask them then to find more than 0.1% of reputable scholars who do not affirm the existence of Jesus. Find us more scholars, Mr. Blogger Online. Find us more scholars, Mr. Weird Guy in Starbucks, than 0.1% of the world scholars that think that Jesus didn't exist before you start propagating that view. So, finishing that. Point 0.1% of reputable scholars who did not think or cannot affirm, essentially, Jesus' existence. Most scholars and historians do not know of the few fringe scholars we brought up. Most scholars and historians do not know of the few fringe scholars we brought up here. When Bart Ehrman was asked on that radio show whether he knew of Robert Price, one of the fringe scholars, he says, no, I never heard of him. So, I mean, a lot of times people just don't even know who these guys are, even scholars like Bart Ehrman. So with that, we can conclude a couple things, and we'll close here. I'll just give you the fill in the blanks. Overall, the best explanation of the facts with the most explanatory power and scope is that Jesus was a real person that really did exist. No other reasonable or unreasonable theory can explain away all the data that we find about Jesus. And the claim that Jesus did not exist is actually completely ridiculous. And so, obviously. So in the next session, we're going to look at... In the next five sessions, we're going to look at all of these claims about Jesus. Now that we know with extreme certainty that he existed, now we're going to look at all the claims that are made about Jesus and by Jesus about himself. And we're going to look at whether or not the Jesus of history is the same Jesus as the Christ of faith. So that's where we're going in the next five sessions concerning his divinity, his messiahship, and the resurrection. So with that, let's close in prayer. Father God, we thank you so much for this night, bringing us here safely, and this new class that we've started. We pray that, Lord, you would help us and guide us in our thinking, in our minds, prepare our hearts each week as we dive into this material, and bless us as we go. In Jesus' name, amen. Amen.